To be or not to be a Buddhist? That is the question tonight. How does this sound? Does this sound okay?
Sounds okay. Good.
All right, great. So in order to be a Buddhist, some people think you have to have a really cool shawl. Like this one, or really cool, you know. Everybody goes out and starts buying shawls. If you go to the Dalai Lama, anybody gone to see the Dalai Lama? The first thing you'll see are all the tables where they sell all the special. But so tonight I'm going to talk about what it means to be Buddhist, not about shawls actually, and how it relates to other spiritual traditions, how Buddhism relates within itself to other Buddhist traditions, just a little bit. Because I only have half an hour, I can't really go deep into all of that. But I did look up to see how popular Buddhism is. And apparently Christianity is the most popular religion in the world, with one-third of the population are Christians. The next religion is Islam, Muslims, are the number two. And the number three is unaffiliated. And the number four is Buddhism. So Buddhism's, I saw a lot of different statistics. One said there are 500 million Buddhists on the planet. And another one said that it's grown in the past couple of years to 1.2 billion. Because apparently China and Russia have both started allowing Buddhism in their countries. And so there's a lot more. It's growing rapidly in these countries. But Buddhism is a religion, if you look it up. And it's a religion, but it's also called a philosophy, right? And it's a philosophy with no central authority. And I think this is why it's probably growing rapidly. There's no rigid dogma attached to Buddhism, and there's no mission to proselytize, so you don't have to convert anyone else to Buddhism. So I was meditating for about 5 years, very ardently. And then I was, you may have heard this story, but I was working out at the gym and there was a bald lady next to me and we were both, you know, working out together. And I worked out next to her for well over a year, and then finally one day I got the courage up to ask her why she was bald. And she told me she was a Buddhist nun. And I said, oh, well, what is Buddhism? Right? She said, well, it's a philosophy, she said, but it means that you meditate, mindfulness meditation, you meditate a lot. You do your best to not cause any harm to anyone, yourself or anyone else. And you also believe that there are consequences to your actions. And I said, oh, I'm a Buddhist. Because these were philosophies, guiding values in my life. So that's when I started becoming really interested in Buddhism. So what is this Buddhist path? So, you know, I like to say this often, and it's really important that there's a to understand or to connect with that sense of intuition within each of us that propels us or moves us towards a spiritual practice. There's an inner knowing that there's a peace, there's a beauty, there's an aliveness, there's a connection possible for all of us. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? But then there's this disparity between this inner knowing and then our day-to-day, moment-to-moment experience. And so this disparity is what often motivates us to come to practice, to spiritual practice. And that may be what it brought you to Buddhism. I know that's definitely what brought me to this practice. So it's also what brought the Buddha to seek out his practice. He was in search of a path to freedom, a path to awakening, a path to greater peace and understanding and wisdom. And then he started teaching this path. So the original ascetic Siddhartha Gautama did not teach Buddhism, right? Because Buddhism did not exist back then. Human beings have taken his teachings and turned it into a religion and called it Buddhism. So the words come out. What the Buddha said that he taught was the Dhamma, D-H-A-M-M-A. And when you look up the Dhamma, it means a lot of different things back in those days in Pali. It meant nature. It meant the law. It meant objects of phenomenon. And what he said he was teaching were the objects of phenomenon that bring you to freedom and awakening, to the nature of awakening, basically, and the path or the teachings that bring you to awakening. That's the way he presented what he taught. And the word Buddha itself comes from the origin root word buddhi, which means to awaken. And the word Buddha actually means the awakened one. So people, he didn't name himself the Buddha. Other people named him that during his lifetime. So Buddhism, it's not a belief system that you have to buy into. You don't have to sign up for it. You don't have to pay anything for it. You don't necessarily have to believe everything about Buddhism. You don't have to practice any prayer, seek anything in particular, any deep yearning. You don't have to follow a guru or a special teacher. But I think it's really important to understand that Buddhism is more of a path of practice than anything, than a belief system. It's a way of life. This is what he laid out during his lifetime, a way of living that'll bring you towards greater freedom, greater peace, greater joy, greater connection. So some people are born into Buddhism, so they're born Buddhists and they become Buddhists, they stay Buddhists because of that. A lot of people become Buddhists because they love this practice and these teachings so much that they choose to become a Buddhist. I've heard other people say that they felt like they wanted to become a Buddhist because they felt like if they could really bury themselves into the philosophy and the way of life of a Buddhist, then they'll get more out of these teachings, which I can truly understand. And a lot of people, especially in the West, I've heard, are drawn to Buddhism because of some negative experiences they've had with other religions in the past. So I was raised Muslim, and then when I left my family, I left religion, and I swore that I would never, ever, 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 should I say that again? Ever get involved in any ism again or any religion. So I was pretty surprised when I found myself involved with Buddhism, because I had great religion to belonging to any particular group or belief system. But once I started studying Buddhism, I saw that it was an ancient tradition of great wisdom, and that there were so many wonderful, a lineage of wonderful teachers that came over these thousands of years with just more and more deep, profound, heart-opening wisdom. So I got really drawn to it. So traditionally, to be a Buddhist back in the day, you had to renunciate and become a monastic. So you had to shave your head off and take robes and become a monastic, right? You couldn't just be a Buddhist, which I find ironic because the Buddha taught both his monastics, female and male monastics, as well as lay people. So whoever came to him, he taught them. They didn't have to renunciate. Yeah. So you, as you know, I renunciated and I was a Buddhist nun about 4 or 5 years ago for the spring. That was my commitment. I'll do it for the spring. Anyhow, it was really an interesting time, and I learned a lot of rituals during that time. There are so many different Buddhists, and I, of course, I'm speaking from a Theravadan perspective, because that's the one that I've been steeped in. I don't know a lot about some of the other Buddhist traditions, but there's a ritual for just about everything, it seems. In fact, I was the one that had to change the Buddha's water every day. Up on the altar, we had a glass of water for the Buddha. So I made sure that I put a nice fresh glass of water up there for him every day. And fruit, too. Which, yeah. But I also found it ironic that there was so much attention brought to rites and rituals in the Buddhist tradition, because the Buddha taught that there are four primary areas to avoid clinging to. Four primary areas. And the first area is, well, not the first, but one of them is rites and rituals. So he warned people to not get overly attached to rites and rituals. The other things that he said to not get attached to were attractive and desirable sense objects. You know, avoid craving, clinging. He said to avoid attachment or clinging to opinions. Anybody have any strong opinions in here? Yeah, I was arguing with a family member today who was telling me what a great person Putin was. Anyhow, so I realized that I'm attached to my opinion. And the fourth area is to not cling to the idea of selfhood. So here's a Buddhist quote, some Buddhist wisdom from Siddhartha Gautama. He says, "Do not dwell in the past, do not dream in the future. Concentrate the mind on the present moment." Concentrate the mind on the present moment. And if you've done this practice for a while, you realize that that's like the crux of this whole path, is to continually cultivate the mind, you know, the mindfulness and the present moment. Keep bringing it back to the moment so that we can actually live our life here now in this moment as it is, not in our head or somewhere else. So one of the primary distinctions of Buddhism that separates it from a lot of other religions is that there's no particular god or deities that you need to worship, right? There's no requirement to reach out of yourself to connect with some outside source that's not already inside of you. Right? So a lot of other traditions, you're trying to connect with God or to connect to the divine or something else that's outside of you. With Buddhism, you don't have to reach outside of yourself. Here's a joke. I have to give at least one bad joke for each talk, so here it is. A yogi walked into a Buddhist pizza parlor and said, "Make me one with everything." When the yogi got the pizza, he gave the proprietor a $20 bill. The proprietor pocketed the bill. The yogi said, "Hey, don't I get any change?" And the proprietor said, "Change must come from within." And the reason that I picked this particular joke is because it's appropriate that Buddhism and this practice is an inside job. It doesn't come from anywhere else but the inside. And the inside job is this prescribed, systematic practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. Right? Anybody feel like they're practicing the Noble Eightfold Path? Yeah. That's the crux of it all. If you don't know much about the Noble Eightfold Path, it's interesting to learn about. It's not really. You don't need to have a PhD to understand it. There are three primary areas of development that you want to practice the Noble Eightfold Path. And the first one is you want to develop wisdom and understanding. So you want to have a higher right view, wise view, understanding of the world. The second area is that you want to cultivate the mind with meditation. Right? So that's the second primary area. And the third one is that you want to develop, you want to lead a moral life, so that you're not causing harm to yourself or others. So it's not just something you can learn about and conceptually know. Buddhism, you can study it all day long. You can take the notes. You can read all the books. You can, but you're not going to get it from conceptually learning about it. At least this has been my understanding, my own experience. To truly understand Buddhism, you have to know it experientially. It's kind of like a fruit. You know what, if you've eaten bananas your whole life, you know what bananas taste like. Someone tries to talk about a banana, you know the experience of a banana. But let's say you've never had, what's a fruit you've never had? No, you don't know any, do you?
Guava.
What is it?
Guava.
You never had guava, right? So if someone tries to explain to you what guava tastes like, they can explain all day long. You can read every book about what guava tastes like, but you're not going to actually know what guava tastes like until you taste or eat a guava, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what this Buddhism is open to everyone and anyone. And what's great about Buddhism is you can continue to be a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim or a Catholic while you're enjoying the fruits of the Buddhist path and the Buddhist practice. And I think that is such a beautiful, flexible, and freeing thing. Yeah. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my understanding of Buddhisms in general. So Mahayana Buddhism, a lot of the Mahayana traditions, Tibetan comes out of the Mahayana tradition. The goal is to become the primary goal, and you hear about a lot, is to become a bodhisattva. That is a being of total compassion who is trying to help and bring compassion to everyone in the world so that we can all awaken together. So this is the bodhisattva path, right? And then the Zen Buddhist tradition, their primary goal is to break through the ego consciousness. So there are a lot of confusing type practices where they try to confuse you with different koans or no, it's not that, but it's not this, but it's not that either. Mm-hmm. But the Theravadin tradition, the one that I've been steeped in, is all about understanding dukkha, which is suffering, right? And then becoming free from suffering, which is awakening. So the ultimate goal is to awaken out of our trance of dukkha and to become a... being, right? All right, so why did the Buddhist coroner get fired? He kept marking the cause of death as birth. Okay. So, you know, even in the Buddhist tradition, there's so much variation. And some people get confused and they say, well, which is it? Is it this or is it that or is it this or it's that? And the way I like to think of it is that you've got this beautiful map of awakening. And if you do this practice, you're going to become more compassionate. You're going to break through the ego consciousness, right? You're going to open your heart and want to help others. It's a natural byproduct of it. Yeah. But some teachers say that we're already enlightened. We're already enlightened. We just have to remember that we're enlightened, or to remove the obstacles to our realizing that we're already there. So you'll hear some teachers say that. And then you'll hear other teachers talk about, no, we need to cultivate the mind and heart so that they can awaken. So those are two different come froms. This is in the Buddhist tradition. A lot of different Buddhist teachers focus on different practices, meditation practices, as the most important ones, because there are so many of them in the Buddhist tradition. But I think that they're all equally special, and that there's not one Buddhist tradition that's the right tradition or the best tradition or the best come from. I think it's whatever we're attracted to, whatever sings to our heart today or right now. What do we need to hear or feel in order to move us forward on our path of awakening, to keep us motivated, to help us be really caring and loving beings, connected beings. So there's also a lot of Hindu non-dual type teachers out there. I went to a couple of their sanghas, curious what they're teaching. And I kept hearing that we don't need to do anything, that we're already there, right? And then this went totally against my conditioning, because I was thinking, if we're already there, we would already be there. You know, we'd already be sitting in Blissville. Anyhow. But it feels to me like humanity, I don't know if you feel this way, but it feels to me like humanity and our evolution of human beings is kind of at a crux or a turning point. Kind of like we have a choice to really move forward developmentally really quickly and far, or we can go really backwards. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? Do you feel it too? But it feels like we're at this turning point, and there's an urgency to a lot of us to really ramp up our meditation practices, ramp up our spiritual practices, get real with ourselves, get real with each other. And that's what I love about this practice. It helps us to be able to do that. So this is what the Buddha said. He said, "Teach this triple truth to all. A generous heart, kind speech, and a life of service and compassion are the things which renew humanity." Generous heart, kind speech, life of service, and compassion renew humanity. To me, that is the crux of Buddhism right there. But generosity is a huge part of the Buddhist path and the Buddhist practice. In a lot of ways, it's the root of our practice. We have to be willing to be generous to ourselves to even do this practice. We have to care about wanting to give to ourselves, right? To give ourselves the 30 minutes a day or whatever it is that we're choosing to do. Did you know that only 10% of all Buddhist monastics meditate? And even less than that in the lay people, Buddhists meditate. So not many Buddhists actually meditate. From what I understand, Buddhist teachers say that the people in the West are particularly, they're surprised at how much we actually meditate here. Maybe we're suffering more, I don't know. But yeah, generous heart is at the root of this practice in order to sit and give to ourselves. The more we practice, the more our heart opens. Has anybody experienced this? The heart opens up, and then we can't help but feel more generous to others as well. reminds me of this quote that I absolutely love from John F. Kennedy. He said, "My fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." JFK got generosity, didn't he? He got that it's not about me, it's about what this generous spirit can give to others. And Buddha taught generosity. That was a big teaching for him. He said to give generously to our practices, give generously to our families, give generously to our communities, and give to the spiritual community that feeds you without expecting anything in return from anyone. So those were his teachings. Generosity, kind speech. When I have a commitment to be kind and not cause any harm, my speech naturally is kind. Right? So if I can remember to have that commitment to be kind and not cause any harm, then my speech will follow. But I just wanted to say that kind speech is not always positive. Sometimes it's giving honest feedback to someone if they're harming themselves or others. I had a fellow that I worked with years ago who was basically a good person. He was really a nice, good person, but he had a lot of insecurities and fears. And we were both in management at this organization I worked at, but he wasn't very skillful. If certain people didn't act the way that he wanted them to act or respond in the way that he wanted them to respond, then he would judge them and punish them and make their lives miserable. He created a lot of harm. I guess he was a great teacher for me to watch the harm that he was causing for others, because I chose to not be that way. Right? So if your speech is ever said from hurt, judgment, righteous indignation, this is not kind speech. Our intention is the most important thing. So if our intention in our speech is to reduce harm and bring harmony to ourselves and others, then this is kind speech. Here's another Yinse, he's a teacher. He said, "In order to be a Buddhist, you must accept that all compounded phenomena are impermanent, all emotions are painful, all things have no inherent existence, and enlightenment is beyond concepts." So we can conceptually spend the next 30 years on those four statements. But they're just beliefs until we, like I said, experience them personally. When we sit in our moment-to-moment practice and we see that things are constantly changing, when we see that our childhood friends maybe are no longer our friends, or that people that we've loved have left, then we understand all phenomena are impermanent. When we feel into our emotions, even if they're really positive ones, if we're fully mindful with excitement or a really positive emotion, or a negative or difficult one or a neutral one, we'll see that stress arises along with emotions. We can feel that in the body. So that's when he's saying all emotions are painful, because stress arises along with them. When we explore ourselves in our practices, we see that there is no self. We just know that there's knowing, and we know that there's a witness, but when we look to find the witness, we cannot find the witness. Right? It's like a dog chasing its tail. It will never catch it. So then we start to have the experiential knowing of no inherent existence. Enlightenment is beyond concepts. If you have an awakening experience, just try to talk about it. The words in the English language cannot come close to the actual experiences. To officially become a Buddhist, you have to do a ceremony in which you take the three refuges and the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and the five precepts. So if enough of you want to do a Buddhist ceremony where we take the refuges and precepts and officially become Buddhists, I'll be glad to lead one. I've offered it many times. Let me know. But you don't have to worship the Buddha, although most Buddhists in the East do worship the Buddha, and they pray to the Buddha, and they, you know, give him food and water and stuff. The Tibetan Buddhists worship a lot of different deities and bodhisattva teachers. So they pray and worship a lot of different things. Other than the Theravada don't necessarily do that. You know, one thing I found really interesting is that there are stories in the Pali Canon of different people coming to the Buddha, wanting to argue their spiritual truth. And then the Buddha listens to them, and then he tells them about the Noble Eightfold Path. And then they say, oh, this is amazing. I want to renunciate and join your spiritual group. And a lot of times the Buddha will let them renunciate, but oftentimes he'll tell them, no, stay with your own spiritual family, your own spiritual group. So he hasn't, if he felt in his heart that their practice, their family, their spiritual family was going to be of more benefit, then he would tell them to stay with their group, with their own spiritual practice that they had. So Buddhism offers a practice that trains the mind and opens the heart so we can live with more ease, peace, joy, presence, connection. That's what it's all about. I am proud to be steeped in the Buddhist tradition. I love this path of practice. I love teaching Buddhism. It has been such a freeing experience for me in my path, spiritual path. But I don't feel that anyone has to be a Buddhist if they don't want to be a Buddhist. If you feel that you're motivated to really own that identity or that title, please feel free to do that. But you don't have to own the identity or the title in order to do this practice and to get great benefit from it. So there's one last thing I want to leave you with, is the simile of the raft in the Pali Canon is a story about how this man wanted to get across this raging river but didn't have a boat. So he made a raft. It took him quite a while with the clay and all the dirt or the sticks and straw and everything. And he finally made this raft and it got him across the river. And then the Buddha asked the question, so he has this long journey, sojourn, ahead of him. Should he pick up the raft and carry it the rest of the way, or should he leave it beside the river? Do you know the answer? Leave it, right? Not carry this heavy raft the rest of the way. And the last line in that teaching is, when you know the Dhamma, these teachings, to be similar to the raft, you should abandon even these teachings. So as soon as we start clinging to and want to drag these teachings around, identify our ego and create an ego consciousness out of this path or this practice, then we need to let that go. That's Buddhist. So you don't have to be Buddhist to meditate, expand your wisdom, and behave with the intention of non-harming, and for your heart to be open with generosity to yourself and others. But if you are, either way, I bow to you deeply.